This is Dr. Tar.
This is Professor. Now it's dark. Heather.
This is Dr. Head.
And this is 16 Sizzling Reasons Bacon.
And you are watching and experiencing.
She is not in my movie.
In heaven, everything is fine. In heaven, everything is fine.
Sure, you can fuck that shit! Pabst Blue Ribbon!
Yeah.
Here they are, Albert. Faces of stone.
Hey, my snakeskin jacket. Thanks, baby. Did I ever tell you that this here jacket represents a symbol of my individuality and my belief in personal freedom?
The worst thing of being old is remembering when you was young.
You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee. I've had, I can't tell you how many cups of coffee in my life, and this is one of the best. Yes,
I am not.
Peeps, we are now paying tribute to the one and only David Lynch, who recently passed away. We are going to be covering his life, his career, and just generally talking about him and our impressions and his impact, I believe, on culture and art in general.
He was not an animal. He was a human being.
A good quote from his second movie. He was born in 1946. Grew up traveling. His dad was a research scientist for the Department of Agriculture. His mother was a English language tutor. He ended up in Virginia. Somewhere in what, Alexandria, that's it, Alexandria, Virginia, where he went to school. He was older by this time. He befriended a person named Toby Keeler, whose father was Bushnell Keeler, who was a painter. And through his interactions with Bushnell, he decided he wanted to become, to live the art life. And he rented space from Bushnell and became a painter, started painting. He did this for quite a while, and he continued painting throughout his life. He was a very abstract, surrealist painter. But anyway, he his formative years, he was middle, a white middle-class American, pretty much. You know, he didn't really, there was nothing really distinguishing. He wasn't very good academically, he thought. The education system was stifling, so he was very prescient on that. He did become a Boy Scout, made it all the way to Eagle Scout. He said he did it just so that he could quit. I don't know what that meant, but I thought that was kind of funny. A lot of this stuff I'm getting is from a documentary called The Art Life, which is extremely good. It's about his life from the time he was born until starting to make his first feature-length film, which was Eraserhead. Before Eraserhead, while he was at the University of Philadelphia School of Art, is that what it is? Philadelphia School of Art, I think. But he made a few short films. He got fascinated with stop motion and did a couple of things. And then he did one called The Grandmother. And this kind of catapulted him into a whole new realm. He got a grant from the Film Institute. What is it called? The Film Institute, Film something, Film Studies Institute in L.A., which was housed in a mansion of all places. And he became just a student there, kind of. But he took over the stable area because nobody was using it, and he thought he wanted to do something. So he was going to do another project, which kind of fell through. And then he started producing and started doing, he wrote the screenplay and started doing things for Eraserhead, which was supposed to be a 6-week project that turned into 5 years due to finances and other considerations, you know, just the circumstances that he was under. He had met the star of Eraserhead, Jack Nance, before this. Jack Nance had a career already. He was traveling in stage plays and did a lot of children's theater. Then he got to San Francisco and became kind of immersed in the avant-garde art scene. And David met him and they kind of hit it off. So he wanted to have him portray the lead character of Henry. And that movie, the rest is history. And we'll talk about that.
One of the most iconic hairstyles in movie history.
Exactly. He made 10 movies altogether throughout his career. Eraserhead in 77 was his first one, 78. His last one was Inland Empire, which he made in 2006.
Didn't he do a short series, too, for a little bit? He had like short little segments. What was it on, HBO? Or does anybody know what I'm talking about?
It's like I don't like an anthology.
No,
not that I know of.
Or maybe he did maybe it was a series of stories done by different artists. But I know he did one of them. It was like a small little.
Well, that could be
episode, maybe.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. We did. He also, you know, during that period in 1990, he and he collaborated with Mark Frost, mm-hmm. and they created and wrote most of Twin Peaks.
Yep.
The TV series, which was aired on ABC, 2 seasons, groundbreaking TV.
Oh, yeah.
The most original TV to come down the pike. I mean, really ever. And it just, and just totally, especially the first season, just really
bonkers.
Captured and people.
And was
surprisingly very popular. But there again, it just goes to show you, you know, that people are starved for something that's a little different.
Different
and then maybe much imitated. Yes. And then Twin Peaks in that style, that you know,
kind of
the let's show everybody's quirky side.
Yeah, kind of. Ensemble, I don't think anybody really came close to Twin Peaks.
I don't think they came as good. I think they tried to imitate it.
Like what?
For the people that had already seen Eraserhead.
Like Northern Exposure.
Yeah, you're right.
Right.
Kind of did. Yeah.
Because the characters themselves are part of the,
right.
the plot. It's not just the thing that happens.
The quirkiness,
The quirkiness drives the story.
And right. becomes like a right. Fargo type. Yeah.
Well, it's you know, like you get to like Northern Exposure and you get like a dollar store version of Log Lady and just things like that. Because it's just they're trying to capture that Lynch thing, but they're just not getting they're not Lynch.
Which is curious. We touched on, you know, watching things that you'd watched in the past and then not like him as well. Northern Exposure is that way for me. I tried watching it again and just did not hit me at all.
Yes.
I liked it
the first time through. Yes, I was a fan.
Didn't hold my interest.
I tried watching it again. Same way, Professor Feather. It was just like I wanted to like it, and I'm like, I got like one episode in. I'm like, I don't think I can watch this anymore.
Do you feel that way with Twin Peaks, though?
I never got to see Twin Peaks because when it came out, I was taking night classes, I missed it.
It was fun. It was like an event.
I rewatched
the people in my class who they talked about it religiously. I could not. I worked.
No, I was just curious. I used to record it
on VHS.
Rewatched the series recently, and it holds up. The first season, like everybody, we talk about the second season. The second season, there was problems. It started falling down. Mark Frost and David Lynch had big problems with ABC, and they left.
Right.
In the middle of the second season, they just left, and it kind of went down here, up and down. Then, you know, still pretty good because it kind of is carrying through what they had created, but not as good as the earlier stuff. Right, but still pretty good, and still some pretty good stuff.
Right. It kind of comes off disjointed, kind of like the theatrical Justice League, which is half Zack Snyder, half Joss Whedon. You could tell. the distinct difference between when Lynch and Frost are there and after they've left.
Right, right.
God, there's a definite disjointedness to that.
They say that, and Dune's kind of that way because of the cuts they made.
Yes.
It's like...
Yeah. You're talking about the Lynch Dune?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that came out. Let's go back a little bit here.
All right, let's go.
Because you know, Eraserhead was his first movie, and this was, you know, this was an experimental surrealist movie. There's just no other way to describe it. One of the things that I really like about the movie, and I thought about really going in depth in the movie, but I'm not going to. I think if you haven't seen it, then shame on you.
Yeah.
Get the fuck out there and watch it. Because
you guys remember the first time you've seen it?
You can't say you're a film buff if you've not seen that movie.
Yes, I can.
Do you all remember the first time you've seen it?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So...
I'm still scarred.
Like, for me, my psychology teacher in high school showed it to us.
Really?
That's
interesting.
Yeah, he showed it. He was a very cool teacher, but he showed us like these off the wall movies.
Yeah.
You know, like Altered States. He showed us Sybil and he showed us Eraserhead.
Yeah.
Among
that's
others.
Interesting. And yeah.
I saw that at a midnight movie the first time I saw it.
What?
Eraserhead.
Yeah, I did too. I saw it in midnight movies too.
How about you, first time. Dr. Head?
I saw it probably on VHS. When it came out, probably 1985, something like that. And
That's when I immediately, as soon as it came out, I bought it. Yeah,
because I've been hearing about it for a long time, and it was all.
And then we got Tetsuo.
You know, all over like my like movie magazines and
talked about it.
So that would have been right around the time that Blue Velvet was coming out in theaters. You're finding Eraserhead on VHS.
Yeah, pretty much. Eraserhead is just so bizarre. It's shot in black and white. I think it's absolutely beautiful. I think the cinematography is just gorgeous. And the other thing of note is the soundscape, which is just fantastic.
It's
one of the weirdest and strangest. And I want to give credit to Alan Splecht, who was the sound designer. He was the sound guy. As a parenthetically, when David Lynch got his grant at the American Film Institute, they hired Alan Splett as the sound engineer for for the whole thing, which David Lynch was just happy about because he was able to utilize all that equipment. And when you listen,
that's a cacophony.
Absolutely pristine, brilliant sound effects and soundscaping, plus the music that, which is very incidental. David Lynch was very, very much into diegetic music. Diegetic means music that's inside of the scene, like a record player or a radio. Yep. That's diegetic music. He was always using it in different forms. And he uses it in Eraserhead in a few places. And he's kind of fascinated with old music and that which keeps cropping up in his movies quite a bit. And jazz and just, blues and all different kinds.
Scratchy.
Yeah. But it's just a brilliant movie. And I know a lot of people don't like it. And I can understand, you know, somebody that wouldn't like it, you know, because it's just not, it's like anything that else.
It's meant to be distasteful.
That I consider art. You know, it's very subjective. You know, one person can like a painting, and another person can hate that painting. So, and this movie is very subjective. But if I just would like to say, if you haven't seen it, I really highly recommend it, and at least try it. It may not be your cup of tea, but you know, or in David Lynch. Right. Case a cup of coffee, a damn fine cup of coffee, but it's a great movie. Well, anyway, an executive producer that worked for the production, Mel Brooks production company, saw the movie and got a hold of Lynch and said, I think you should, because Lynch was looking to direct something that wasn't his. He said, I want to do something else. So they put some feelers out, he was actually offered a couple of Star Wars things at that time, and he turned them down. Oh, thank God he turned them down.
He was offered. He was offered Jedi. He was offered Return of the Jedi.
But he turned it down.
I'm curious about that one, but.
So he went, and she said, "Look, I think you ought to, you know, come and you know, we think you'd be good." So Mel Brooks went to a showing of Eraserhead, and David Lynch was in the lobby while he was watching the movie. He said Mel Brooks came out of the theater, saw David Lynch, ran up to him and hugged him, says, "You're a madman. You're in." So he became the director of The Elephant Man. Which, when you in retrospect, you think, you know, here's Eraserhead, this absolutely bonkers movie, Then he takes on this project that becomes so good, so beautifully done.
I mean, and keeps the same kind of texture and feel.
Kind of.
But and stays with the black and white.
He does it in black and white.
The soundscape is kind of very
gritty, gnarly.
It has signatures, it's also beautifully lit. Different than Eraserhead. You know, so different. And so
there was a story. There's a story as well that once Mel Brooks felt that he discovered Lynch after Eraserhead, he takes him around Hollywood, kind of to introduce him. And they're at one party. Elizabeth Taylor runs up to Lynch. You know, shakes his hand furiously, says how much she loved, says how much that she loved Eraserhead, and according to David Lynch, then they make out. He says they kiss several
probably
times.
Probably true. That's probably David Lynch was kind of a hound. He was married, I think, four or five times. And another thing that we can talk about, even in Eraserhead, not so much in The Elephant Man, but something that occurs throughout his thing is psychosexual situations.
Oh, absolutely.
In a lot, especially his original stuff. He's very obsessed with sex.
Big time.
Quite a few of his
movies. Most explicitly Wild at Heart and Blue Velvet.
But Elephant Man was critically acclaimed. Very highly acclaimed. So, you know, that put him really on a good road.
One of my favorite
Stamp
is
meets
exactly, and this is one of my favorite Lynch movies, The Elephant Man. Also, too, you get a youngish Anthony Hopkins here too,
Hurt plays
the cast. Amazing.
That's a great
performances.
Cast. There's nothing to criticize about the movie.
Elephant Man's one of those near perfect movies for me.
Well, then after that, he runs.
Is that his most commercial movie? Like maybe
Hold up. We'll get to that.
Right.
The next movie, he hooks up with Dino De Laurentiis.
Yes.
Says, "Yeah, I want to make Dune, Frank Herbert's Dune."
Yep.
And Lynch at first wasn't sure, but then he read the book. He says, "Oh, okay. You know, this might be kind of interesting." So he says, "Yeah, and I want to write the script." So he starts writing the script, and he's finding that it's just so hard to put all this stuff into a movie. So he gets Frank Herbert to come in to write the screenplay with him. They turn this screenplay in that's probably over 3 hours, 4 hours long.
It was like 4 hours.
It should have been two parts.
Something minutes.
Dino De Laurentiis, David Lynch went to Dino and said, "Look, I think we ought to do this in two parts." And Dino said, no, that will fail. Nobody does two-part movies are no good. We'll never do that.
Right.
Yeah. Thanks, Denis Villeneuve. Anyway,
he cranks out.
Who's going to make a three? It's going to be a three-part movie.
So he ends up, you know, making Dune, which there's parts of Dune, of the first of his Dune I like. There are parts that just don't work very well. I think he was too constrained. I think the budget wasn't as big as it should have been.
And special effects at the time just weren't up to what needs to be shown.
What Herbert utilized the best facial effects ever. I don't think.
I guess I'm thinking more of the cheesy lighting animation effects. Yeah, but
yeah. That's why I said it. But and it was a box office failure. I mean, just nobody liked it. It was just right. and I I liked it at the time. I didn't have any real problems with it. It was uneven in places, and I had read the book, and knew things that had been left out and all that. But I like some of the acting. I like Kyle MacLachlan, who became, David Lynch's protege. I liked him in it. I liked, what's her name that played the little girl? Alicia Witt?
Oh, yes. She did have that creepy.
That's the best role she ever played. That was, she was
cute,
and she was very, very creepy.
They had to overdub all of her original dialogue, though.
But it's not.
It comes off super creepy.
See, Dune to me. I have things called first half, last half movies where I really enjoy the first half, but then the wheels fall off the bus in the second half, last half. And Dune for me is a first half, last half, because I think because they cut the budget in mid filming and then they had to rush to try to get what was the rest of the story crammed into the last 40 minutes of that movie, the wheels completely fall off the bus. So that's a first half, last half movie.
Yeah. My wife, seriously, Mrs. Tarr, wanted to go see Sting and a little...
In the little panties?
Whatever the thing he has on. That was her big... Okay. We'll go to a David Lynch movie. Sure, we'll go.
Getting to a Queen... Sting and man panties getting into a West Side Story style knife fight.
Dr. Tarr,
I liked it.
Do you wear those at home?
We do a little cosplay, yes.
Only now he's not Sting, he's Stung.
I've been done stung.
The spice must flow at Dr. Tarr's house.
Yes. We've got to have to control the amount.
Just got to shoot the worm.
You're training me.
Just got to shoot the worm the right way to get the spice out.
Okay, so after Dune, which came out in 1984, his next movie came out in 1986. Which was Blue Velvet. Now, Blue Velvet is one of my, but here again, this is one of my favorite movies. I really, really like this movie. It's disturbing, but the thing that's different about this, and this is why something I really like about Lynch, he makes Eraserhead a totally bonkers, surreal romp. Then he makes The Elephant Man a beautiful movie that's great, very very linear, very easy to comprehend. Then he makes Dune, which is he probably it's going, give me another cup of coffee and then a cigarette. And then so he decides he's gonna do another original, and he makes Blue Velvet. Now Blue Velvet, if you watch Blue Velvet is not a surreal movie at all. Blue Velvet is grounded in reality. Right. There is nothing surreal about that movie other than the situations you can say that's surreal.
There's weird characters, but it's not a surreal.
There's not a surreal movie at all. It's a very linear
weirdo
movie.
It just has weird.
I guess it keeps it surreal with the characters.
It's a psychosexual movie.
Yes. It's a lot of Dennis Hopper psychosis is where people think that it's such a weird movie, and it's really.
And at the time, I was super into Dennis Hopper.
He's such a weird character.
We were so into Hopper at the time, too.
Right. Well, this is my favorite Lynch movie, and this is probably my favorite Dennis Hopper movie.
Is it? Yeah.
I think so.
But it's a very, very kind of. It's also a lot of people don't really understand. I don't think it's very satirical. It's a very satirical movie from the opening scene to the very closing scene. The satire
Start idyllic and then the heart attack. Idyllic. Yep. Yeah. You very idyllic and then the heart attack shakes up the idyllic stuff. And then Kyle MacLachlan has to come home from college because his dad was the one that had the heart attack, and then finds the ear, and then everything just snowballs after that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And Kyle MacLachlan, he's Lynch's muse. He's also often, because Lynch always writes a stand-in for himself in every movie. There is a character that is so much David Lynch in the movie that you can identify that, you know, that character as being the Lynch character. And usually it's Kyle MacLachlan. But Kyle MacLachlan in Blue Velvet is I know he's a protagonist, but he's kind of a creep. Like creeping on the neighbor girl who's still in high school and has a boyfriend. And then he's hiding in the closet at Isabella Rossellini's place. He's kind of creepy.
Yeah, who wouldn't hide in Isabella?
Well, I know, but Jeffrey's a little
it was a sniff and panties part that was like
oh yeah.
But yeah, he is. You're right.
Jeffrey's a little creepy.
And the whole situation between him and
right. Well, also it made Jeffrey more complex, which made you want more of that story. That propelled, you know, Jeffrey's complexity in all those different situations, the situations with the Laurie,
with all the other Dern, messed up people exactly. in the script.
Right. Right.
Well, yeah.
You know, and you know how Laura Dern is infatuated with him. But then when the reality hits her and you just see the horror.
And he really loved that pie, too. Yeah,
yes. So. But the horror on Laura Dern when Rossellini steps out and with the whole he put his poison in me and just the abject horror on Laura Dern's face is just
ugliest people who cries.
She does make when she the cries, best ugly she is cry just face.
Fucking ugly, man. Oh, yes. God. Oh,
my other God. Than Shelley Duvall. Ugly
cry face. Oh yeah, I think way better than Shelley Duvall's.
Better than Shelley Duvall. I don't know anybody that
her face almost turns it. Her face almost becomes a Jim Carrey animated face.
Yeah,
like her mouth turns down so hard. Yeah. Right. She has the best.
But ultimately,
so is that good? I mean, is that a good act?
Yeah, no, she's. I think she's a great actress.
She also comes back. You know.
Yes.
So
at the end. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I love the story. I love the script, the screenplay. Like I said, you know, it's full of wit. There's a lot of funny things. We'll talk eventually. Jack Nance, who is Jack in Nance almost is a every Lynch movie yep. made. He's
super creepy.
He is, he's a creepy guy in this movie.
Gets to punch
Jeffrey.
Yeah. That's what I said. It's very, you know, I just really, I fell in love with the movie. I've seen it. I don't know how many
Chucky's
times,
in there.
Times. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Oh yeah. Brad Dourif. Yeah.
Yep,
oh,
yeah. Brad Dourif is in there.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah, that. Oh, what's
full
his name?
On that Brad Dourif,
Candy Coated Clown.
Who was that?
Oh man, yeah.
I literally just watched this movie a month.
I know. I just it's on the tip of my tongue.
He had that makeup on.
Yes. Yes. A good side story about that was when Roy Orbison saw the movie. Absolutely hated it.
Yeah,
I'm sure he did.
But then, but he went back and watched it again and went, oh, okay, he got it. He understood right. what Lynch was doing.
Right.
I like that.
Lynch, by the way, was a huge Roy Orbison fan. He loved Roy Orbison.
Right.
Oh, who was that?
Oh, golly.
Dean Stockwell.
Dean Stockwell. Yes.
I could see him, and I couldn't think of who that was. Dean Stockwell.
Yeah. Yeah,
Werewolf in Washington. Washington.
Like, literally,
yeah.
I was just looking at his face this morning while I was watching Mulholland Drive.
What was that TV show he was in? Quantum Leap.
Quantum Leap. He's great in Quantum
He's
Leap.
Great. No,
I love that show.
That
so
show
much.
Sucked. I hated it.
I hated it. I don't think
him,
I watched it.
But I liked him. I didn't like the show at all. Yeah.
Wasn't he the hologram?
Yeah.
What a great name.
So anyway, to move on. After Blue Velvet, and Blue Velvet, I think it was pretty much a hit. I think it was commercially viable.
There again, it was at the time of VHS too, and it probably went on the VHS quick.
Exactly.
And just started.
Well, then after that,
also too, when movies start having long shelf life due to HBO and Showtime, things like that, in the early and mid '80s, you're getting movies that have these 5 and 10 year shelf lives. Thanks to
but they also started at that time like censoring what they wanted to show. I mean, and then you had to go to the video stores. I think I found this stuff like
Oh, yeah. I watched all this probably on video first before
we went to Sue's. Yeah.
This one, Blue Velvet, I saw in a theater on the Army base when I was in basic training.
Yeah. Yeah. We saw it in the theater, too.
Yeah. I saw it on the Army base during basic training.
Then in 1990, he came out with another of my favorite movies of his, Wild at Heart, which was based on a Barry Gifford story, but Lynch changed it quite a bit. The whole theme of The Wizard of Oz and the Elvis was not really part of that.
I wish I remembered more of this, but except I just vividly remember Nicolas Cage doing an Elvis impression
for
100% of the movie.
Yeah.
Nicolas Cage as Elvis as whatever his character
is. Yeah, he even gets up, sings a song.
Yes.
And then at the end, sing. And then it is him singing it too, you know.
It is.
I think it's one of his best performances. And another person in the movie who is absolutely brilliant is Willem Dafoe.
Yes.
Plays the really fucked and weird, fucked up drug dealer guy. who goes into Lula's room and,
William Dafoe is another guy that
I remember liking Diane Ladd's performance too.
Yes.
Laura Dern's mom in real life.
Harry Dean Stanton is in it.
Harry Dean Stanton, who's never bad.
Who appears in several of Lynch's movies. Yep. Lynch really liked him. And he's never bad. You're never absolutely bad. Right. But here's another movie that it's a straight movie, straight ahead. It's a road movie, romance movie. The only flights of fancy are when Sailor gets knocked out and the good witch, Glinda, the good witch comes and has a little pep talk to him because they had been talking about The Wizard of Oz, him and Lula. But the movie is grounded in reality. There is nothing that's in that movie that could not be really happen, you know, which is here's Lynch coming through with his style, but a relatively linear, straightforward story, you know, which I thought was
also
pretty good.
With the psychosexual nature as well. I mean, there's some pretty vivid sex scenes between Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern.
Yeah, that's not really psychosexual. That's just sexual content.
With some of the sex scenes, he had the wavy cam and the fisheye, and you know, there was he filmed some of the sex scenes kind of like an ass.
But it has also he's the way they look and stuff, and just the way it's filmed is that they have that kind of a almost exploitative type movie.
Yeah,
look
right.
To
they do
it too.
Yeah, they do. They
almost
do.
Like a Skidamax movie.
Keeping it keeping it like a drive-in movie almost. You know, just keeping the sexual. You know, just how they. Yeah.
There no.
But flowing it, I could see where that would be an influence with it too. Just.
Well, during the 90s, it's actually starting in 1988, Lynch wasn't just doing movies. He was doing commercials.
Yes.
He did in excess, I know he did right around 26 commercials from 1988, and his last one was in 2014.
Featuring his fetus kid.
I went through... all of the commercials, they're all fairly short, you know, so you could watch them all. There's one that's not short that I would like to talk a little bit about. Some of them are Lynchian. Put it this way, like his first commercial is Calvin Klein's Obsession for Men. He actually did three of them. The first one is based on a quote from F. Scott Fitzgerald. The second one is on a quote from Ernest Hemingway, and the third one is D.H. Lawrence. They're all in black and white. They're all kind of...
I can't remember them, but...
Kind of weird, kind of odd. And here again, he did a lot of perfume commercials, because if you notice throughout history, perfume commercials aren't normal. They try to be artsy. And so he fit right into that. I mean...
Yes.
He did that. He did... during Twin Peaks, he did a series of commercials for Georgia Coffee, which is a Japanese coffee in a can.
He Japanese?
Did, yeah, it's did Japanese. He did one, two, three.
And they call it Georgia's four. Coffee?
It's Georgia. It's called Georgia. Yeah. But the commercials take place in Twin Peaks. Kyle MacLachlan is in it.
There's
a Japanese
funny.
Guy with a Japanese girl who's gone missing.
Oh yeah, Japanese guy. Oh,
no.
Yeah.
If you watch all four of the commercials, they're a little mini story. And it's brilliant. It's just brilliant how that works out, you know.
Japanese cared? Advertising.
He also did
Laura Nagasaki.
Yeah, he did a New York Department of Sanitation commercial in 1991, which is in black and white, which is really, really bizarre and good. You have to see it.
It would probably be the only in-service movie that you would probably watch.
Do the sanitation workers find the creepy baby thing from Eraserhead in that commercial?
Dude, I've been coming in for years. One was good.
He juxtaposes people up in the city throwing trash. Right. And then down into the sewers with all of the rats. Yeah. And it's kind of a juxtaposition between the two. It's very well done. It's very well done.
And they all had.
But he did a lot of commercial. He did an Alka-Seltzer Plus commercial. He did in 93. He did a Barilla pasta commercial. Yeah, I mean, he did like a bunch of perfume.
Malincian pasta.
Gio by Armani.
Not being weird. I like to eat.
He did Opium by St. Yves Laurent.
I'd be curious to know.
I thought very odd. In 1977, he did three of these shorts for the Sci-Fi Channel. One was called Ant Android. One was called Nuclear Winter, and one was called Rocket.
Huh.
And they don't make any sense. They're real short.
Have you seen them?
Huh? Yes.
Have you seen them?
I've seen them. Yes. I watched
YouTube or something.
I watched all 26. Yeah, there's.
I was just wondering.
Let me tell you, anything you want to know about David Lynch, you can find out on the internet, on YouTube. No, everything. That's where most of my research happened. Yeah, absolutely. Right. I watched all 26 of these commercials in one video.
And I was kind of wondering what he might have been funding with those varied commercials. But now that you bring up the shorts, I think that might have answered my question at least. To a degree,
he wanted to make
no, and this was a capitalistic thing. This was money. Right. He made scads of money off each commercial.
Oh yeah,
he could probably have lived his life comfortably just from his commercials. David Fincher,
same way to an extent.
Yeah, yep. Yeah. But yeah, there's a bunch of them, and some of them are good. I wanted to bring up this one because it was very odd. He made it in, let me see, where was that? It's kind of, maybe I got it here. Okay. Here it is. Oh yeah. It's a Dior commercial made in 2010, but it's a short story. It's 15 minutes long and it is pure Lynch. Right. It is really good.
I
don't know what it had to do with Dior. There might have been something to do with it, but it was really good. Really good. I mean, I was just blown away at how good it was. But they must have given him a small fortune to make this, you know?
Dior has a lot of abstract commercials.
Yeah, they do.
In general. So
anyway, all throughout
his career. I want to see David Cronenberg get a cologne commercial.
But throughout his career, he was making commercials all along.
They're the fetus with one. And David Cronenberg's cologne commercial, there's a disfigured fetus with three eyeballs floating in the perfume.
Fetus 39. Yes.
So then in 1992, he comes out with the prequel movie for Twin Peaks called Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me.
Yeah.
This is where David Lynch and I part ways. I absolutely hated the movie. Hated it. I thought there was no reason for it. He should have just left well enough alone.
It was just a commercial venture.
Right. See, I was kind of hoping for closure. I didn't think we got proper closure at the end of the second season of the
show.
I was hoping for closure with Fire Walk With Me, and I was just angry.
Fire Walk With Me was pretty much a sequel or prequel.
It's a self-indulgent mess.
Totally obsessed with sex in that movie. totally obsessed with sex. Lots of sex scenes. One of the most sex scenes he's ever had in a movie. Right. And I just didn't like it. I wanted to, but I just didn't.
To me, again, another Skinamax on acid was kind of.
So then, you know, he kind of took a break for a little while and making some commercials and doing some other things. 1997, he comes out with probably his second most enigmatic movie ever, Lost Highway. Lost Highway is really, really hard to describe. It's a kind of a noir story with absolutely surreal and fantastic elements.
Is it Josh Brolin?
The mystery exploring man. It's a
condemned man.
Well, yeah. Jeff Daniels is the lead, and Arquette, the pretty Arquette.
Roseanne.
Arquette. No.
Sorry.
Is it Roseanne? Is David. The pretty one?
Rosanna's cuter than Patricia, I think.
No, Patricia. No, I disagree. It's Patricia Arquette is the good looking one. She's in this movie. Roseanne is.
Who's the other one?
Not very good looking. David. But anyway, I like her.
Changed.
She's a great actor. Just not, you know. I'm superficial. I like the looks, you know.
He really likes David.
But it's a very, very strange movie. Very strange movie. Yeah. There's a juxtaposition. It's a movie about identity, primarily. And there's a juxtaposition at one point where Jeff Daniels' character becomes another character who's played by, what's that guy's name? Thoreau.
Thoreau.
Justin Thoreau.
From his own fantasy. Well. Yeah. Yeah.
It's Balthazar Getty.
No, it's Balthazar Getty in this. The other guy is in Inland Empire. I get the two of them mixed up because they kind of look alike. But yeah, you're right. Balthazar Getty. But
great name, by the way.
It's just a really hard movie to describe. Not very well received. A lot of people just said it just didn't.
Oh, because it's in the sky. Yeah.
It didn't make sense. You know, there's a lot. It's probably Robert Blake, who plays the mystery man, kind of the devil.
Yeah, I remember not having an interest in revisiting it after I saw it the first time, just because I thought it was so self-indulgent that it's just like, this was just David Lynch wanting to make a movie to show, to look at me, world, being David Lynch.
Oh, you think so? I didn't get that.
I found it self-indulgent.
Everything he did is self-indulgent.
All right, but I think this was self-indulgent without a leash of any kind.
I remember not liking
Lost Highway very much at all.
The thing I liked
Robert about Blake character, I thought was more reality instead of death. You know, it's like his.
No, he wasn't reality at all. He kept.
No, his reality was intruding on him because that is not the life he was living. This was like when he was already condemned.
No, it wasn't. He met Robert Blake way before that.
Right.
At the party, at the house.
Exactly. When he. Yeah. Was
that's why I said
with
that's
all
where
these
that,
other.
That's where the whole surreal element starts.
Right.
Coming into play, you know. But yeah, no, I considered him. Yeah, like I just call him the mystery.
Well,
I don't really think he's the devil. I don't think
he's pre-murdery, you know, Robert Blake.
And so, very, very odd movie. And I want to bring up something else that I thought was kind of interesting. How people utilize some experiences in their past in their lives to then visualize them. David Lynch, one of his visualizations is the highway.
Yes.
Going down the highway, the lines, the darkness. Yep. And I'm going, you know, and he uses it a couple of times
Wild at Heart.
Yep. And so I'm going, that's interesting. Well,
Mulholland
I was watching
Drive.
Watching
what's the talking
I don't remember
what's
where
going
let
up.
Me I'm trying to think where I've, oh yeah I think it's the Art Life documentary. He's relating a story where he's in Philadelphia with these other students, art students, and they decide to go into town and they smoke pot. And it's the first time David Lynch has ever smoked pot. And he becomes the driver. So he said he's driving down the road and he says all he can remember is watching the lines on the road, you know, right. going. And he said, then the next thing he knows, they're going, what are you doing, David? He goes, I'm driving. I'm watching the lines. No, you're not. We're stopped in the middle of the expressway. They had stopped the car totally right in the middle of the expressway.
Good shit.
But I just thought that, you know, there again,
like that's Cheech and Chong, the episode we had.
That's something I think that's kind of funny. How, you know, using something kind of out of his past, whether he even kind of realized that, you know, but that just kind of became a theme, you know, a visualization of that.
Yeah.
You know,
a moving that, forward. That yeah.
Yeah, I just thought that was kind of interesting.
Lots of POV from the front bumper of a car shots and David Lynch things.
Yep. Well, after that, he made one of my favorite movies by him, 1999. It's called The Straight Story, which is based on a true story about a 73-year-old man who drives a riding lawnmower, I don't know, 600 miles or something like that, to visit his brother who's just had a stroke. And he hadn't seen his brother. They were kind of estranged over like 20 years or something. It's an absolutely wonderful movie. There is no conflict in this movie. There is nothing that is David Lynch in this movie at all, other than it's a road movie. Somebody commented, well, it's a David Lynch road movie. No, it's not. If you didn't know David Lynch directed this, you never know David Lynch directed it.
No, it's bright and super heartwarming.
Great.
And,
yes. Right. And great sweet. Acting. Almost sweet. Farnsworth, one good, of his.
Yeah. You know what's really cool is that he felt like doing that, though, too. You know, making it heartwarming. And not,
well, he didn't.
You know, like, I mean, it was a conscience.
It was the story.
Yeah.
It was his girlfriend at the time who wrote the story, and she was the influence of doing it.
Okay.
And I think she even became his wife eventually. But yeah, let's go back to Elephant Man or Dune. He was not above making just a straight ahead fucking movie, you know, which I think is just great. I really like that about him. And I loved Straight Story. If you haven't seen it, you need to see it. It's a wonderful movie.
So that affords you then the ability to do other things that are less mainstream. Like if you get a commercial that's success for someone, then you can afford to do other things. Yeah,
It's a one for them, one for me.
Yeah. And I know we're going to get into each of these movies later on and got more things to say, but I can appreciate anyone who can do a variety of those things for both personal and commercial reasons, because you still have to be a working person.
Yeah.
And if this is what you want to do, this is what you do, you know?
Right.
Money doesn't come from nowhere.
His statement on this movie was, he loves it. He said, it's one of my favorite movies that I ever made. I think probably because it's just such a good story, you know? And there's nothing weird about it.
That's what I'm saying. There seems to be probably his least stressful movie. It's probably his least stressful movie to watch, for sure.
Absolutely, absolutely. And just brilliant. It is brilliant. After that, in 2001... He made Mulholland Drive, which was part of what they were considering his L.A. trilogy.
My favorite Lynch.
Is that where Justin Theroux is in? Or
yes, Justin Theroux. He's in. Justin Theroux doing a flat out David Lynch impression, up to the hairdo, up to the coffee, up to the everything. That girl is not going to be in my film. Like the nasally delivery of his voice.
It's another very enigmatic movie, another surrealist movie, absolutely surrealist.
With a weird mystery.
With the weird,
like Blue Velvet.
Weird mystery.
The actress
is unlike Blue Velvet. It is fantastic. It has fantastic elements, very surreal in a lot
of ways. Naomi Watts is amazing.
Another one that is primarily deals with a couple of things. It deals with identity primarily.
Yes.
And then it also just deals with Hollywood in a lot of ways.
Yes, absolutely.
And consumerism. We could go into in depth. It's another one of his movies that wasn't like accepted real highly. I mean, it was, you know, by the crowd that counted, I guess you could say. I would say, because I'm a snob, but I don't know. I really liked it. It's confusing. There's stuff, but I think the actors are good. Here again,
right?
Sex. Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Here's his second foray into girl on girl sex, because he did that in Fire Walk With Me too. But I liked it. It's not one of my favorite movies by him, but I liked it. And then his last movie he made in 2006 was had a couple of special notes. It's called Inland Empire. It's over 3 hours, I think, 3 hours and 1 minute or 3 hours something. It's over 3 hours long. It Laura has Dern. A singular distinction, and Laura Dern back.
Yep.
You know, Grace Zabriskie, who's in almost all of his movies.
Yep.
Jack Nance had died by then, so he didn't get a chance to be in it.
Exactly.
Unfortunately. It has the singular distinction that he shot it on a Sony prosumer camera because he discovered it and he liked the idea that it was small and that he could get it into really tight places and he couldn't get his other cameras. And it was very mobile. And when you see the movie, you can understand. It's funny because it has that look. It looks like a prosumer camera movie. It doesn't look like a, you know,
like a GoPro.
It looks better than most prosumer there because he knew how to light. He didn't skimp on the lighting. He didn't skimp on the audio for most. He said sometimes.
I will say that for
sometimes he actually used the onboard mic as the audio sometimes.
Did he?
I will say that about. I'll say that about Lynch's movies in general as far as lighting. That's one thing that really sticks out for me is even in
the
movies that I don't like.
That's the painter coming out.
Exactly. Right? Even in the movies of his that I don't like, I can admire how beautiful he lights things. Yeah. Like, I'm not a big fan of Eraserhead, but I can acknowledge that the lighting in Eraserhead, though, is absolutely absolutely beautiful.
It's like beautiful. A Goya painting, right. Decaying apocalyptic landscapes. So, you know, the textures
I agree with you. It's the painter in him coming out and the way he lights things.
Well, Inland Empire, even though he does do good lighting and stuff, it still has places. And I went, this is curious. Why is that light blown out?
Right.
Heard an interview and he said, no, I did that on purpose. He said, all of the stuff that looks like it's the artifact of the canvas. He said, I used that as my canvas. He said, there's nothing that's not
dirty it up. Yeah.
Not meant to be there. It's my least favorite Lynch movie. I found it just not
engaging to you.
It just didn't engage me at all. There's parts of it that I really like, that I think are really good. I like the main story. It's the main story is very odd. It's about this woman in Bulgaria, I think, or something. And she's actually she's actually watching things that are going on, and she becomes interacting in the story. It's there again. This is one that defies description. It's really, really hard to describe what this movie is exactly about. I mean, it's definitely about identity again. He's very.
That's the charm to these movies.
It's Hollywood, how Hollywood works. But a lot of the movie is shot in Bulgaria. And it has a whole different look to it. I like those scenes. I liked all of that way better than I liked a lot of the other. Laura Dern does a great job. Oh, this is also Cronenbergian. You'll watch a scene. She's in a movie, and you'll watch and her and the lead guy start having an affair, start kind of getting together. Well, you see that it cuts this one scene, and they're going and all of a sudden you think it's real life, and all of a sudden cut. You find out, oh, that was a scene from the movie. Then another time, she's doing something. She stops and she goes, are we still making the movie? Is this the movie? This feels like a scene right out of the movie. I'm going, I like that self-referential, you know, and how the identification of it gets so mixed up with the
muddled that reality. Yeah.
Yeah. That theme going throughout was pretty good. Overall, I thought it was way too long. I thought it could have been probably done, you know, in a lot less. And I probably would have liked it a little better. I just kind of got bored with it. I thought it went on a little too much. It was his last movie. And I watched, I don't know how many interviews. And I wondered, why was that his last movie? And I finally, just the other day,
across he's making cologne commercials
for an interview with him. And because I thought he just didn't want to make movies anymore. He goes, no, he says, I just, if I find the right property, I'll make it. He right. says, I just haven't found anything that I want to do. He said, so I'm doing other things. Yeah. Yeah. He was making yep. commercials during that time. And, you know, and he had his place, his house where he has his, David Lynch was an artist, a painter.
Yep.
He was a woodworker. He was a sculptor. He was a, he made
multifaceted
some of the coolest lamps I have ever seen.
Right.
You know, they're really good. I'm going to go out on a limb here too and say, I don't like his paintings. They're just not what I like. They're too dark. They're too muddy. And he was asked, well, why are they? He says, I have a hard time working with color. which I thought was kind of weird. But because
color was kinda he an oil out. Painter? Was huh? he an right. oil painter?
Oil painter. Well, yeah. Mixed media. I mean, he did everything.
Oh, I didn't know.
It's weird. Oil, right. It's weird bigger that painting. He considered
oil. Oil, you can get muddy super quick. I mean,
yes. Right. But it's just, that's not he mixed, considered, he didn't consider the paintings muddy. He considered those like colorful or thought people didn't know how he used color, but you see things like,
But then
you look at his movies that are, you know, like Mulholland Drive, and like
you can't make
Blue Velvet.
I mean, Andy could have been.
Someone can't say he doesn't like color and then watch Blue Velvet.
No,
you paint with oil too, like, you can do.
He didn't like color. He said he didn't like color in his pictures necessarily. Right. But that's not true. You look at his body of work. There's a lot of it has color, and
that's where I was going. Is like just look at Blue Velvet.
Yeah, he was obsessed with words in his paintings. He would use words. He would use found objects that he would stick into the paintings, and you know, just a true artist.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, that was like I said, I did not finish the art life, but the parts
you can touch the moonkey.
But the first half of it that I saw where it's, you know, where it is Lynch meandering around his various studios at his property, that's really interesting just to see.
Who would
even when the shot is just like 2 minutes of him sitting in a chair smoking, the stuff that's on the shelves and on the walls around him that he created,
it's composed.
You don't need to worry about looking at Lynch for the 2 minutes while he's sitting there smoking, because you're looking at all the stuff that's surrounding him that came out of his head that he put into reality.
Yeah.
That's where it became really interesting.
Yeah.
And that's where you see that he's a real artist.
What are you going to say, Gadfly?
Just sit there.
He directed What Did Jack Do in 2017, a short film that was on
short film, yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to mention that, but you're right. He just had. I was talking feature length. He just had decided not.
Yeah,
to, he had found hadn't found anything that he liked. That, and he. But he said, "I'm not done." Until the fire,
right.
And he had to evacuate, and he had emphysema. That's why he died.
Well, I'm surprised he didn't leave quicker. I mean, that was. You know, with
right. Well, I don't know when he left. He just evacuated. He could have evacuated early. I don't know.
Right.
Yeah, evacuated. I don't know. He died from emphysema. But he was, every time you saw him, it seemed like he was smoking.
Oh, my God.
He smoked.
Legendary smoker.
Smoker and
lover he should have been in bacon.
Coffee and Cigarettes.
Yep. Oh my God. He should have been
in Jarmusch's movie.
Everything with Lynch was.
No, that's for the big bacon, cup.
Bacon, eggs, gravy, cigarettes, and coffee. That was his life.
The other thing I would like to say, you know, and I don't understand. I've kind of wrestled with this. There are very few people of color in his movies.
Right. But I mean, if you look at late 70s, unless you're portraying them as random gang characters, most people didn't have a lot of people of colors in their movies in that area. Anyway,
hey, Living Dead,
not really.
Sorry. I know. It just was a curiosity. You know, it's
right.
I don't think he wasn't racist or anything. It just
no. I think it was just.
I just found it curious. But right. and I also understand culture. he's right around my age. He's a little older than I am when he died. So we had pretty much kind of the same childhood. Watching the Art Life, he's talking about his childhood. I'm going, oh, fuck, that was my childhood. You know, right. almost exclusively, except I didn't become a Boy Scout. But yeah, so anyway, that kind of covers, we haven't covered everything. He also did a whole bunch of music, did collaborations with people. He did several albums. He did this one song that I particularly like. I hate blues, by the way. Don't like blues at all. I mean straight Mississippi blues, Kansas City blues. I don't like that. He did this song called Star Girl Dream, and it's a blues song, but man, is it weird. And it's really good. And he sings it.
I can see that, because that sounds like something he would put into a movie.
The song sounds like
he has several songs that they show up in his movies as needle drops, and you're trying to think to yourself, have I heard that somewhere? Like, you think it would be a song you'd know, but it's actually a song that he wrote specifically for the movie, but he wrote it in a genre that makes it sound like an older song. So you're like, what is that song? And then as you're watching the credits go by, you're like, you know, by David Lynch, sung by David Lynch. You're like, what?
Yeah.
He would sneak those throughout his whole career. He would sneak his own songs into those needle
his
drops.
Major influence in music was Angelo Badalamenti, who is a composer, who did, I consider, one of the absolute best theme songs ever, which is the theme song to Twin Park. Twin Peaks.
Twin Peaks.
Twin Pikes is a whole different movie.
Twin Parks was even
different.
Twin Parks and Rec.
Oh, look at the Grand Tetons.
But anyway, do you all have that that music in your head?
Yeah. And the porn version, Twin Perkins.
If you haven't heard it lately, go on YouTube and find it. It is iconic. Man, is it beautiful. One of the most beautifully composed.
One of the best openings for a TV show.
Especially
period.
A theme.
Yes,
theme song.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. The opening.
And he said that
Angelo Badalamenti
was his pretty much his inspiration. Into music and you know that kind of thing. And like I said, I mentioned, you know, Alan Splett, who their career kind of coincided.
Right, the sound design.
So a lot of the soundscaping and stuff was not just Lynch. It was Alan Splett. Talking about Alan Splett, he said, yeah, back then the sound people didn't have a reverb unit. He said, so Alan was looking around and he found all these air ducts. So he put the microphone at the end of the duct, and at the other end they would put the recording. And then run it
That's
through,
yell,
and then they would, and they would do
echoey.
It several times until they start getting the echo, the reverb echo that they
right.
want. Right. That's
cool. That's smart. That's
practical effects.
Smart.
That's
right?
Just cool. That's just cool. That's why
that's
that guy was
creativity.
A sound engineer. You know?
Again, creativity.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I thought that was.
Really that's cool. An artist.
But I personally could talk forever about. Lynch, you know, we've already gone over
so multifaceted about
we could probably anybody have anything they'd really like to say, you know?
Oh no, I found Lynch too. I found prior to even seeing Eraser, I found a book called mid 80s cult movies.
Okay.
And I was going through that and like listed at the time, you know, like big cult movies. Cult movies were like the thing at the time. Midnight movies and such.
Midnight movies, yeah.
Yeah, and they were showing them around. Anyway, this was in there. And then I don't know when, but it just, anyway, it came. I had a chance to go see it on campus. And so I went there. Yeah. It was interesting. Nice. It was fun. Yeah.
If nothing else, I mean, you know, he was an influence, you know, he was definitely, you know, a cultural icon, I think, in many
true
ways.
Multimedia artist.
True multimedia
and again,
artist.
Almost as famous as just being a cultural figure as he is as being a movie maker. Just true. David Lynch in the culture in general. Exactly.
And that's why he's a very Renaissance man. That's why I kind of wanted to do a tribute. Culture. And also to let people know, I mean, that he did so much more than just 10 movies.
Exactly.
You know? He was just an all around artist.
Well, the physical media that he created. What makes him a cultural icon is the fact that you hear that he only made 10 movies, and it's shocking to you that how can it be that that guy only made 10 movies?
He's considered one of the best filmmakers.
Well, he has an IAN at the end of his name. You got so many imitators that people can describe other people's movies as Lynchian, the same way as you could say Hitchcockian.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah.
Does that make us a lynch mob?
It does. I'm part of the lynch mob.
Yeah. Oh,
maybe it could.
I'm smelling a lynching. Yes.
I'm more cold and hot. I might be a Lynch cadet.
Anything Lynch else Cadetian. Anybody want to say? Nothing?
Even later. I was just kind of waiting. We were going through all the movies and we were just kind of, I thought I was waiting for the discussion, like at one movie at a time, but were you just kind of hitting them all, or you still want to do a deep dive? Like we're going to go into each movie
wanted to do that, but I think it's just not necessary.
We want to do?
Do you
two
think
episodes?
It is? I mean,
no. It's fine. I was just being referential. Right.
If you can get someone to at least watch them, maybe they'll feel a need to.
Yeah, I just have a few things to say. I'm not a fan. I cannot stand Eraserhead. I've tried three times, and it is a fever dream to me, and that's why it is so unsettling.
It is. It really is.
And I just don't want to put myself through it.
I was just going to say, did we want to make this two parts and have the second part being about the movies that we've all seen and can, you know, talk about?
We can do that. Since you said
you wanted to do a two-parter, that's why I was
I kind of thought we'd go through, but I'm not really sure.
We could do the movie by movie in the second part.
Yeah, that's what I said. If
you want to, that's fine. If not, you want to go on to something else or just do one?
I think we've pretty well covered everything. I mean, if anybody hasn't seen any of these movies, I suggest you go out and try to find them wherever you can. Well, good luck on finding Elephant Man. You will not find that unless you buy it on DVD.
Could we all just
available out on the torrent sites.
Pick our top three, and then that could be the suggestions for the audience. Each of us have a top three.
Sure, you can do that. You start.
And it that way. For me, it is Mulholland Drive. Actually, no, it's Blue Velvet by a hair. Mulholland Drive right behind it. And then Elephant Man, because Elephant Man, to me, I thought was just beautiful. It was, you know, people, if you know, when you first see it, the shock of the sight of the John Merrick character kind of, you could almost see it, absurd, right, exactly, but the story is so beautiful, and he humanizes him in such a way, in the way he directs John Hurt into that character, that movie is just beautiful to me. So for his straightforward movies, it's The Elephant Man. For his Lynchy movies, it's Blue Velvet and Mulholland Drive.
Dr. Head?
I'm not nearly the fan. I think Elephant Man is the only movie I'd probably really want to watch again. I mentioned my loathing of Eraserhead. Dune, I thought, was really pretty to look at, and I loved seeing the Guild Navigator, but the writing and the story were an absolute mess. Like, it was sloppy-handed, and like the bad retelling of the story, and like just it was felt very disjointed, and it just was a mess. It was pretty more style than something.
They tried to cram too much into such a short amount of time.
Yeah, but it'd been a 4-hour movie written by Frank Herbert. I'm there.
Two movies.
I'm there. Right. Yeah, two movies.
I think that would have been.
Because the Villeneuves are as close as that we're probably going to get to
well,
that.
Well, I think we can talk about that.
I mean, they're gorgeous. And, you know, I mean, I also love the Sci-Fi Channel version. I think that's a very, very accurate, faithful.
I think the most telling with the Lynch Dune, though, is that the Villeneuve Part 1 ends where the Lynch movie is already in the third act. So you, the Villeneuve two-parter, you have a whole movie to fill out of story where Lynch only had an act. So basically 40 minutes to wrap up an entire movie's worth of story. So he had 2 hours and then of to, you know, to pace it the correct way and then cram the rest of the story into a way under budgeted third act, and that's what makes that movie so weird and disjointed and funky.
So Dr. Head, you only have one, that's it?
I'm just going through, you know, awesome. Wild at Heart, I just thought was so bonkers, and because I had never seen it before, and so I watched it, man. I'm like oh, this is just absolutely ridiculous, this shot of the good witch. I'm like, oh god, you know, it kind of it was so satirical and so over the top that I could appreciate
cocaine
the campiness.
Is a hell of a drug.
almost like watching Drive Angry, you know, there's that, it's just that it's so very much David, you know, or Nicolas Cage, you know. I did Blue Velvet, I've seen twice. I other than Dennis Hopper's performance, his performance is just so engaging and terrifying. It's like watching Ray Liotta or Joe Pesci in Goodfellas. You know, you just cannot not watch it.
Right.
But I don't like the movie. I just
sending you a love letter.
Yeah, I just don't. I think Tarantino gets his. Right. Wanting to write the way he does because of Lynch. So much of a purposeful dialogue that's like self-reflexive and sometimes just an absolute silly. And I'm like, and it really like rips me out of the moment because the writing suddenly gets so bad. I'm like, oh,
can I say something? Say something super quick about Dennis Hopper and Blue Velvet though? I think that, the Academy gave him his nomination for Hoosiers as an oops, we screwed up for not nominating you for Blue Velvet. I think Hoosiers was his makeup nomination.
Hoosier Danny.
Yeah, I disagree because he was brilliant in Hoosiers.
Right, but
Hoosiers is a lot more accessible to the committee.
Exactly. That's why I think he's a lot more interesting, and I think he's a lot more electric in Blue Velvet.
But I don't like his movies. I just there's something. I mean, the Tractor one I watched. I'm like, okay, so I see where it's going. I kind of thought, okay, this is done really, really
good.
Nice.
God, John Deere.
I can appreciate his artistry. It doesn't mean that I like it. I want to watch Twin Peaks because everyone's been talking about it for 30 years and like, okay, yeah. So I found it. So you I will watch it. No, I haven't watched it yet. I'm going to. It's on my list. Like, yeah, I will watch it.
You know, for $250, you can get the little midget guy dancing figure. It's about like 14 inches. It looks cool as shit.
So what are your top three? What are your top three?
Mulholland Drive.
I would say Eraserhead just because that kind of like pulled me into a lot of looking at weird movies and just strange movies other than the norm. Wild at Heart. Saw that with Mrs.
One
Turner.
In your pants.
Yes. Made it so much better.
And I'm spent.
And Twin Peaks. Twin Peaks being on, you know, and knowing who this was, yeah, before it even came out, people had no, you know, no one saw Eraserhead or anything like that. You know, they didn't know what was coming up. Then all of a sudden, Twin Peaks comes out and just listening to people talk about how weird it is. And it's just like, I love this.
Yeah. I mean, if you were familiar with Blue Velvet, Twin Peaks makes a lot more sense if you are already familiar with like Blue Velvet
and
there is so much there is so much of his previous stuff in Twin Peaks. But, I think, you know, that's what, but people that
the
were
the vast
TV
majority
people
of people had never seen that stuff.
TV just, people didn't know who David Lynch was, and so that just hit them like, what is this? Like,
I'm surprised that they let it go. You know, with a lot of
there were things I was surprised they got away with, especially in 1990s network TV. There was some stuff I was like, wow, I'm pretty shocked they let this get through.
Midnight Gadfly, do you have three or you want to give them or not?
It's Blue Velvet, Wild at Heart, and Lost Highway.
Lost Highway.
All right. Very good. I guess that pretty much calls it. We're already over an hour and 15.
Well, what are your three?
I'm not going to say.
No. All right.
That's not fair.
I don't have three favorites. They're all my favorites.
They're like your kids.
Pick three right now.
There's nothing. Eraserhead.
Yeah. I was going to put money on that one.
Yep. Yep.
Set mold.
And that Dior commercial.
But I really like. And the Dior commercial. Yeah. No, I like everything. There's qualities. You know, I have a couple I okay. I would never put Fire Walk With Me on any list that I liked. So.
No.
That was a total failure for me.
Oof.
At least this year, maybe next year I'll have a different opinion.
Hey, this is a great movie.
I haven't found the right strain of weed to make me enjoy Fire Walk With Me yet.
Yeah, you guys want to watch me take a dump? Say!
Welcome to Bowel Sounds. You've been listening to
On Extras on in a Tibetan way.
Oh, Transcendental Meditation.
There's 16 David Lynch was a transcendental meditation guy
for years and years and years. I forgot to mention that. I thought that was just going to interest.
Yes, he was.
That's just half of 16 reasons to listen to Unsane Radio.
So, yeah. unsaneradio@gmail.com, Unsane Radio on Facebook, unsaneradio.com, tarnfeather.com, Tarn Feather Psycho Cinema on Facebook.
Ted, you're up.
Oh, Heavy Metal Horror. Heavy Metal Horror Podcast. Heavy Metal Horror. You know where we're at. We're on YouTube. We're here. Montag Lewis on Instagram. Heavy Metal Horror. And Sizzling Bacon?
Webhead62 on Instagram if you want to see my artistic scribblings. If you want to hear me rant about shit, The Nerdery, THENERDERY, 1967. On YouTube. And then also you can get Unsane Radio Podcast on Spotify and Apple Podcast and all your other podcast outlets.
For all your podcast needs.
For all your podcast needs.
And let's not forget
allow 6 to 8 weeks for delivery.
We are fucking needy. Sorry.
WBEFREEKZ web family friendly web comic on Facebook, and the Midnight Gadfly will be at the Midnight Lonely Fans site all week, so you can go.
I thought
help
it was
him.
Fan only. I thought that was
no, fan lonely. That's what
lonely fans. Lonely fans.
Sticky hands.